This podcast episode is powered by AfriPods, the world's number one podcasting platform for African stories.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to We Are Curious. So it's been a fascinating week full of a lot of things happening in Africa, in Kenya, in the world. And to just dive right into it, we don't want to waste a lot of time today. So we do have a lot of discussions to go through from the COVID vaccine in Kenya, from the Safaricom Wahala, with the fair usage issue, to Africans joining multilateral bodies and the crypto bans across the continent, the Facebook Wahala in Australia, and a whole lot of things. So without much ado, I just want to say special thanks to one of our guests today, Papa. So he's going to be joining us and discussing a lot of the things that we get to talk about. And without much ado, okay, you have to edit that part of it.
Actually, that goes as is. That's a new man.
Yeah, okay, cool. And without much ado, let's just dive right into it. So regarding COVID-19, we've seen the threat down in Tanzania rising. So the number of cases, undocumented and obviously without official government data, going up. There's a very interesting piece today done by David Peeling in the Financial Times on COVID-19 cases, and that the government of Tanzania has asked its citizens to dedicate themselves to the Lord and pray that the cases of COVID-19 come down. It's obviously a very, very difficult situation, not just for the country, but for nations across the continent. Obviously, with the danger of different variants coming up, with the danger of those cases spreading across our nation and other nations, the neighbor TZ, and even across the world. So, but then again, we have to give kudos to the African governments for coming together and deciding that by next week, actually, majority of the nations are going to be receiving, I think, about 16 million doses across the entire continent. And that's just a very important first step. But then my thing is, what does everyone feel about this pandemic? And do you feel like African governments have done enough, not just to tackle this from an economic perspective, but also from a healthcare perspective, and importantly, from a security perspective? Because we cannot underlook the value of having a security framework around dealing with a pandemic. And I think Papa would potentially go fast on this. I have to put you on the spot, bro. I think it's only fair.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. It's a tough question. I think African governments have reacted differently to the pandemic. The complexity of the pandemic is that it challenges health issues. So essentially the healthcare systems of our countries, but it also challenges the economic fundamentals of some of the countries in terms of fiscal deficit and also in terms of the revenues that the countries would get. I think most countries in Africa has actually responded quite adequately to the pandemic by supporting countries and people in many different ways. By injecting liquidity and also making sure that people still have access to, mobility, which is very important in most African countries. So I would say that in general, the response has been relatively adequate in many countries. Some countries have started receiving vaccines. Countries such as Senegal are already rolling out vaccines.
Sure, you're proud of that. I saw President Macky Sall spoke about that today.
Yes, I think it happened yesterday.
Yeah.
So I think overall the response has been adequate, but we still need to be very prudent to make sure that the short-term economic consequences don't turn into long-term structural issues for our countries, especially when it comes to managing debt levels.
I don't know if, Eric, what do you think about it? Obviously, countries are investing hugely towards acquiring vaccines, and there's obviously this very huge fear. We did see our Cabinet Secretary of Defense write today to the UN about vaccine nationalism and that worry about vaccine nationalism becoming a real issue. I don't know if you have any opinions around how nations are trying to figure out this vaccine issue and how potentially that would affect economic recovery going forward.
interesting. What stood out for me in the week, I think, was Rwanda was one of the first countries in the week, I think, Rwanda was one of the first countries, countries in Africa, I think, to announce that they'll be receiving their doses this week. I think that's one thing that really stood out for me. And then what also stood out for me was this sort of optimism around global markets in terms of the potential of if vaccines are rolled out across the world, then economies will rebound and we'll some sort of go back to where we were from an economic standpoint. Yes.
Does anyone have an opinion from a healthcare perspective? Because obviously there's that one fear of these vaccines, right?
Yeah.
Have they been tested enough and have they potentially worked to understand our genetic composition as Africans and all those other issues? Obviously, we know that Oxford did do a bit of testing with some of those vaccines here, but does anyone have that fear in any sense that this vaccine might not potentially work well with us?
I think maybe for me, what I would say is, yes, there's been good response by government. So again, South Africa followed suit. I think this week as well, with Cyril taking his jabs. But again, if you look at the leader in the current vaccination, who has sort of like vaccinated the most population per 100 people, that is Israel. I think they're close to 80 now. They've actually almost vaccinated the entire population. And they've seen a lot of actual efficiency in terms of above 80% of success in asymptomatic cases. And that goes to show that, you know, there's actually a positive step health-wise. And I feel what African governments are going to do following the case of Rwanda is they're going to start with sort of like the frontline workers, so the healthcare people who are actually most vulnerable.
Yeah.
And then look at the strategy that Israel employed, where they started with, again, the elderly population, and sort of did that first, because then you're covering the most vulnerable people who would actually be infect the rest of the population. And then you now move to the least vulnerable population. So I feel like we have started, we have made the necessary steps needed. I'm very curious to see what Kenya's strategy will be when the vaccines get here. Is it a week or two?
Yeah, next week.
So because I expect again the frontline healthcare workers to be taken care of.
Yeah.
Because you remember, I think earlier, was it earlier this year or late last year, when we had a lot of issues and cases with doctors succumbing to COVID-19 because they didn't get access to PPEs or medication or just proper proper ways to sort of protect themselves. So I'm really looking forward to Kenya's response to especially in vaccination rollout.
100%. And I did like this piece by the Africa CDC today, saying that potentially Africa will cover 35-40% of their population by the end of this year, and potentially up to 60% of their population by the end of last year. Obviously very, very big steps in that regard. And overall, I think we have to give points and kudos to African governments for taking very, very drastic steps to not only deal with this crisis, but also work to ensure that the population is healthy. Economically, we are well sorted out. It's not the most optimal. We potentially do not have as good measures as most Western governments in terms of protection majority of our population. But I do think that governments have done a very fair job in that. And that sort of like offers a very good segue towards the next topic, which is Africans leading multilateral bodies. We did see this week Ngozi Iweala joining the World Trade Organization as the Director General. And we did see Makhtar Diop, I hope I pronounced that correctly,
yes,
joining in the IFC as the EVP and Managing Director of that. And that's a very, very big step into it. And obviously, we do not have a shortage of Africans leading bodies at the very top or doing a very fantastic job. We had Tijan Tiam at Credit Suisse. We do have people such as Adebayo Ogunlesi, who's reading GIP and doing a fantastic job in fixing infrastructure across the world. But then two things that I want to discuss from that is, do you think that now that we do have Africans at the very top of these bodies, these multilateral bodies that directly impact our economic well-being, that would have one, an effect on that? And second of all, I potentially want us to have a very brief discussion on the old age annoying concept of brain drain, which in my opinion, I feel is, excuse my French, a bullshit idea in the 21st century. So I think you should go first. What do you think about Africans joining, potentially joining these large multilateral bodies?
Hi everyone, it's Felix here. So first of all, before we proceed, I'll just say something. Tanzania, you guys are here and now you're seeing what's happening with Tanzania. First of all, probably as we continue with COVID-19 in Tanzania, maybe one thing that they need to do is to account for all the funds that they received from the EU.
Oh, they
year.
Did receive a bit of money?
Yes.
They did. For COVID response?
Yes.
They actually did.
Oh, but the COVID doesn't exist in Tanzania.
So,
so where's the money?
Exactly. So maybe that's the first thing we need to... I hope that the government of Tanzania will work on that. And then another thing about you mentioned about Africans leading some of these global bodies. I think to some extent, I won't say that it's an advantage for Africa. These leaders who have picked up various posts in global organizations, I think they're picking them up from a point of qualifications. And I think that's one thing that is good for the continent generally in terms of brand and image. But I think, you know, the main challenge that we have from a local context is the main challenge that we have as African governments is it's not in terms of who's representing us anywhere. It's in terms of the governance systems that we have. So I don't think it's going to be any great effect or any great change, considering also that these global bodies are being run not only by one individual, but by a board, a larger board, and I think that's something that's going to be interesting to see. On a very exciting note, the Mars Perseverance rover landed in Mars yesterday.
Yeah.
And we got to see very new images of Mars for the first time since 2012.
Yeah. Felix, have you bought land in Mars? 50 by 100 plots.
I know he has a telescope.
I know he has a telescope.
So he can see the land in Mars. I'm not sure he's bought it yet.
This guy, hey, he has exposure there. Papa, obviously, it's exciting that one of your countrymen has gotten named to the IFC. And the one thing that I have to give Senegal kudos for is having a lot of people in very, very high level positions across. You do not have a shortage of high quality talent and doing a fantastic job leading these bodies. What do you feel about this? And do you see any impact? And have you previously seen any impact with Senegalese citizens being at the very helm of these bodies before?
Yeah, I'll just take a step back and comment on Ngozi's appointment at the WTO. I think Ngozi's appointments and Martha Job's appointment are extremely groundbreaking.
Yeah.
Because to take the example of the IFC, the IFC has never had a non-American or non-European
word
CEO before.
Yeah.
And I think the symbolic impact of that is extremely significant.
Yeah.
Martha, the new IFC CEO, has deep Africa experience. He was a country manager in Kenya.
Yes, he was.
So he understands the continent really well. And I think what's...
And emerging markets as well. He
exactly.
did do a bit of
and
work in Brazil.
Markets, yeah. So he has a wealth of experience across many emerging markets. But I think the most important thing is to understand the agendas that those organizations have.
Yeah.
And the reason why Martha is well positioned to deliver IFC's agenda is that he understands emerging markets really well. IFC 3.0, which is the new initiative that IFC has been rolling out, focuses on emerging markets in the toughest countries. So we're not talking about the usual investments in South Africa, or Kenya, in Nigeria.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about investments in Burkina Faso.
And Eritrea.
In Eritrea. In really difficult markets.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the organization is going.
Uh-huh.
That's why Martha's appointment is extremely important.
Yeah.
Mahtar doesn't have any bias about the continent. Mm-hmm. He will be able to He's one of us.
Yeah, 100%.
He will be able to drive that agenda forcefully.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an important step forward.
Yeah.
To come to the question about, I think, brain drain, a little bit related to that. I think to take the example of Senegal, you're right. We have many high-profile individuals, the World Bank Group, WTO, UN, etc. I don't necessarily think that it does a disservice to the country.
Okay.
As long as we can also make sure that locally, so in our countries, we can also have the same talent. Mahtar is someone who studied, grew up in Senegal,
uh-huh.
you know, and so many other examples as well. So I think what's important is to make sure that locally we build capacity in our universities.
100%.
And we also pay more attention to human capital, which also include things like soft skills.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what's missing in some countries in Africa.
Yeah.
But I don't think that brain drain, which is essentially having Africans living or working abroad.
Mm.
Like I'm Senegalese, but I work in Kenya.
Yeah.
I don't think it's brain drain.
Mm.
You know, it serves the common.
100%. And before I come to you, Eric, it's the one thing that I consistently feel about the idea of brain drain. It did crop up when Africa did have a shortage of human capital, but then Africa no longer has a shortage of whether domestically or globally, because we do not hear of the idea of brain drain when potentially talking about Sundar Pichai, the head of Google, or the guy who leads IBM now, or the guy who leads Microsoft. They're all Indians, but then you never get to hear of that idea of brain with India. And it's the same case that I want to potentially think about this continent as well, because we do have very, very skilled individuals, people who are doing things at a very, very high level, building great and exciting companies and working on these great and exciting organizations across the world and having an impact. And I don't know what, Eric, you think about that space and the whole general idea of it, because now it's no longer about having so many problems in Africa and stick in your continent and solve them, don't come to the US and do it, which was the whole premise of the idea behind brain drain.
Yeah, and I think just to go back to Dr. Ngozi's obviously appointment, she has quite an impressive CV, an actual work done. So if you look at what she's been able to do previously in initiatives, especially in low-income countries in her tenure, say at the World Bank, there's actual, you know, track record of having put in place sort of like policies and having implemented projects. And even as finance minister for Nigeria, I think she's been instrumental in negotiating for, you know, like debt, you know, deals with the debtors, where, you know, in some cases, I think there was a time she was able to get about 18 billion just written off from credit. And looking at where Africa is at the moment, where we have this recurring question about debt, because again, we took a lot of debt to sort of manage the pandemic, and there's been countries that have actually been they have a debt stress, so to speak. So having someone who has experience in these countries in the continent that actually understands the problems of the continent from a country level, having served as a finance minister, to a World Bank level, having served there as well, is very important now when you put that in the context of trade, because we are looking at things like, again, the African Continental Free Trade Area coming into effect this year, and, you know, what does that mean for trade for African countries, for Africa as a continent.
Right.
So having someone at the helm of the WTO is obviously very, very important, given that we can all agree that trade among African countries and as a bloc with the other continents or countries is actually very, very important in this day and age. So for me, I think it's a big win. It's a very, very huge win, especially in same week, WTO and IFC, it's amazing news. So I'm very, very excited.
And guys, I'm sorry, but I have to throw this whole nationalism thing into the cards. Ngozi is obviously a very, very good candidate and fantastic candidate. But can you just be honest? Do you think Amina was a bit more qualified than she is in terms of dealing with trade issues? You were being very, very honest.
No, she was not.
Wow.
That's unanimous. We don't
even have to say.
Let's not discuss
that. Hey.
It's unanimous. She was
guys,
nice.
We're just going to have to call the president and tell him that his people do not actually appreciate some of these candidates. I mean, Ali, I don't know if you have any opinions around having these Africans going to the very, very top of these organizations. And obviously, do you think it's going to have any impact on it? We, again, are not short of highly skilled Africans on this continent. I mean, we have people who are writing amazing code. We have Africans scaling at the very top of these organizations across the world. Heck, we have an African who owns Gatwick Airport. But then, yeah, goodness, he does own Gatwick, right?
That's a full episode.
By the way, not many people know him.
Not many people know him. Not many people know about Debayo Ogunlesi. He's a great, great, great guy. He's done fantastic work. He was on the Trump advisory, economic advisory. Yeah, of course. Trump knows. So I don't know if you have any sort of thought process on that.
I did have thought process, but then everything that I would want to say has already been said. So maybe I think moving on would be more prudent.
I think having an African representative in all these big job positions, I will compare it to having, for example, when you celebrate having a woman leading a very big corporate. So you're providing an opportunity to have a voice that was never even given before. So the same, having Africans leading big corporations like AFC and WTO, listening or getting insights from African perspective and not the imposition of having maybe a European representative or someone from the US.
From Switzerland.
it's something different. The same way you can compare to the tech industry. It's doing very well in Africa because we are providing solutions for actually things that are impacting us directly. So,
speaking on Eunice, just to add on Eunice's comments, one of the things that I learned this week is that the initial team that wrote, just to add on what Eunice has said, I think it's a matter of skills. I think at the moment where we are, the continent, we have more than enough skills to share with the global.
100%.
But I think what stood out for me is, I think as I mentioned, is that one of the things that I learned is that the initial team that wrote the code or built the Amazon Web Services was actually a company based out of
South Africa. Cape Town,
And eventually that's how, what's the name? Andy just came out of that team.
Yeah.
And he's now leading
Amazon now.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh shit, so it's an African who's leading Amazon now.
Literally.
No,
he's South African.
No, no.
He's not South African?
He's not,
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
I mean, and that sort of like segues into a very interesting point where I think every single person here is deeply passionate about Africa and its transformation within our lifetimes. Actually, not within our lifetimes, within a generation. It's something that we can potentially achieve. And Felix, I'm just curious, what do you think about this? You've obviously got very, very deep exposure to the capital markets, and you've seen what kind of asset classes that investors are looking at, and what kind of, and it just sort of like gives an outlook on what the future of this continent looks like, because again, investors are now just going to pump their money into things that they do not think have a future. So in a sense, what do you think of this whole thing?
Well, I honestly believe that the African markets, in terms of capital markets, I think our markets still have a very bright future. Here's one challenge that I always pose out to individuals, even if it's on the Kenyan market or on global markets. One thing that I usually inform guys is that we need to have a lot of activity in terms of retail investing and even corporate investing on our capital markets, because you know, if foreign investors are actively investing on various capital markets within the continent, then I think that it basically shows you just what sort of resilience or what sort of future that our capital markets are probably holding.
Yeah.
An example is here in Nairobi, we're constantly seeing foreign individuals sustain the activity on the market, where you find if foreign investors are not on the market, we can't actually probably even hit a turnover of 100 million, to be honest. So
$1 million?
Yeah. It's that bad. So you'd imagine if we don't have foreign investors hitting onto the market, if you get on the retail side, we can't. If it's purely retailers, we can't even hit 50 million in terms of a daily turnover. So if foreigners are constantly taking about 78, at times even 90% of daily activity, it basically means that for them to bring in their investment to our capital markets, then basically shows that there's something they're seeing that we're most likely not seeing. And so that's a major challenge. And it's not only here in Kenya. If you're looking on the other markets that are actually now trying to control just to what extent that foreigners can actually invest in their capital markets. We've seen countries like Nigeria, we've seen Algeria, we've seen Zimbabwe try to curb foreign dominance on their local markets. I think that's something that would be really interesting to see how it goes. Yeah. But I think it's also the challenge for the local investors, because I believe that you can't stop someone from investing in your country. You can't stop guys from investing in your markets. As much as guys would always want to control the market, the government would want to have a grip of the market by having a lot of local participation, but you can never control. If foreign investors want to invest on your market, then it's up to the local guys to really counter what these guys have on the market. So that's something that's very interesting, but I think our market still have, we have a long way to go, and I think we're not going somewhere, we're not going back, we're actually going up. We're looking at our indices gaining, we're looking at prices, we're seeing companies gaining because a lot of regulation is also coming in our markets. We're seeing a lot of regulators trying to build in a few lapses that we've had over time, like when it comes to regulation on corporate governance. We're seeing a lot more fundamentally stable companies listing on African markets, and also even those that have listed are trying to at least correct in terms of places that they've had issues with corporate governance. Yeah. That's something that I really think we probably look into.
Yeah, you know, and I think I think just before you proceed, and I think within us we have the CEO for HISA who's trying to solve that problem. So I think this is your sponsor segment, Asoma.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. I think looking at across African markets, was looking at the data for the last few weeks. And one of the things that stood out was that Zimbabwe is actually one of those markets that registered very high turnover, and even some of the counters that had gained as much as possible.
It is.
Very highly. So, and I think that could be a reason, things to do with inflation and all that. Mm. But I think one of the challenges that we've had across most of the frontier markets is retail investors, it's hard for retail investors to participate in their local markets. And that's one of the things that we are trying to solve at HISA. So our hope is to start with the local markets first, then open that across other African markets. So I think it's a learning journey for us to see how do we build infrastructure, the technology around this space, and then give Africans ability to access in African markets.
And I absolutely know that you guys will crush it. I feel sad that we'll have to brush off over that issue because we have so much to talk about. I don't know, maybe you can let us know. Do you want us to speak about less and less things in an in-depth manner, or more and more things in a whole sort of like touch and go manner? And because that offers a very interesting segue in terms of African governments and their averseness towards cryptocurrencies. Mm-hmm. We did see Nigeria doing a wholesale ban around anything. In fact, you have anyone in Nigeria who's trying to fund their crypto account having their bank account suspended, which is a bit ridiculous when you ask me. It's not like something that we didn't experience here. It has happened in Kenya as well. But I'm just curious, why do you think African governments are very, very averse to crypto? Right at the moment where we are seeing every single sort of like corporate organizations and government starting to accept this, not just as an asset class, but also as a currency. And second of all, seeing a whole lot of price appreciation in this, because we understand what crypto could potentially do for a lot of African governments here and African nations here from an economic perspective. Felix, please take it away.
Here's the challenge. If our government had put in the reserve fund, the Kenyan government, if they put in the reserve fund when at the beginning of the COVID period, when they put in the central bank reserve fund in crypto, man, now
how
we
much?
Be, we
how
be,
much?
Actually, even if they just put, just say, half a million, no, half a billion. Can you manage half a billion as a country right now?
Half a billion dollars.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I think we actually can. Mm-hmm. But if central bank could have put that would have been some good money. Mm-hmm. Instead of us continuing to borrow funds from IMF,
you had to go there.
Yeah, because I think we I think was it on Tuesday when we received funds
long
from
debate.
Yes.
Long landing debate.
Oh. Okay, disclaimer, that's just my personal opinion, but I think that's something that would have been interesting. Looking on crypto with the African ban, I think it's very sad that some of these countries are trying to probably downplay crypto and think that this is something that's not going to happen. Blockchain technology is here to stay, cryptocurrencies are here to stay. The main challenge, in my opinion, why I think countries are trying to probably regulate crypto is this. We have countries, we've seen crypto, gold and dollar don't mix. Whenever we have crypto rising, we see the dollar lose and also gold will likely lose.
Yeah.
Actually, I think this week, for those of you who've been following markets, if you're looking at gold ETFs, how they've been performing, it's been on a downward trend for the first time, I think, since around January 2020. Which is something to look into. But my thought process is most of our reserve banks or most of our central banks have most of the currency value stored in gold. So these countries and most of these, just an honest opinion, this is my personal opinion, I think they're trying to regulate this so that we do not have a lot of investors putting in more money into crypto. Another thing is we've seen Nigeria, I think, according to probably some few statements that I've read from Nigeria, I think we discussed that last week, Eric,
yeah.
and we mentioned that the country had actually mentioned that one of the main challenges they're receiving about crypto is that it's being used a lot in money laundering,
mm-hmm.
and one of the examples is these phishing scams that we've had over time,
mm-hmm.
on mail,
mm-hmm.
and if you've never received that email where you're being told you have some 250 million stored somewhere and you're required to send some money to Nigeria first, those are some of the challenges that they were facing. But I honestly believe that some of these things the Central Bank of Nigeria would have done way better in controlling crypto and probably accepted, the same way the other day we saw South Africa form a task force to probably test and see the performance of blockchain, specifically looking on cryptocurrencies. So I think that's something that it's a lengthy discussion whenever you talk about crypto,
yeah.
But I think cryptos are here to stay, Eric.
Yeah.
And I would, on behalf of Nigerians, please, Central Bank of Nigeria, can you please allow us to trade?
Anyway, just Felix, just to hold your thoughts on the IMF, and I want us to just dwell there, just a little longer. So obviously we've looked at the Kenyan government reaching an agreement with the IMF, and
yeah.
Also I think there's plans again to raise funds by the Eurobond. Yeah. For me, I think
another
my question
one.
Is one.
Yep.
So why is it that wherever the IMF come to town, taxes go up?
Maybe just to start off before I give it to. To Papa to proceed. Do you guys know that Bolivia actually returned the funds that they received from
yes.
the IMF?
See that?
That was
amazing. Yeah, that was amazing.
Oof. So I don't know, maybe Papa can proceed from there.
There's a lot of aggression towards Bretton Woods institutions. But anyway, please.
I wanted to touch on crypto first.
Yes.
beat around the bush.
I wanted to touch on one shoot. Yeah, I just wanted to touch on what Felix said about crypto. I think the reluctance or the skepticism about crypto is not unique to African governments or Africa. I think globally, a lot of leaders, a lot of smart people, Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, have raised concern and even doubt against crypto. The issue that we have here is essentially trust. The reason why people value things like gold, money and the currencies, that it's a store of value, but there's also trust around those instruments. There's a lot of suspicion about crypto because of the illegal activities that sort of are embedded or that are also inherent to the instrument. Mm-hmm. My concern is that we are actually focusing on the wrong angle. I think the angle that we should focus on is essentially trust. How can we make sure that there are enough safeguards and governance around crypto, not just in Africa, but even globally, so that people can actually be much more comfortable with it. The reason why when you go to DRC, for example, you don't use local currency, you lose US dollars in DRC, is a lack of trust. And it boils down to that, whether it's in Nigeria, whether it's in Kenya or in Senegal, we need to make sure that people like Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, understand that there is a possibility and there's a need, of course, for better governance and much more trust with respect to crypto. So I don't think that we should sort of say that the reluctance is unique to Africa. I think it's a global debate that we should have about crypto.
Okay. But then I think on the case of the African governments, it's extreme, and especially the banks, going to the extent again of shutting down marketplaces and, you know, having banks suspend accounts. Because for me, that aggression is actually where we have an issue with, because prior to the Central Bank of Nigeria's ban, Nigeria was actually the second largest
crypto market in the world.
You know,
second,
so
bro, I tell you, FIRS in Nigeria just realized they're not making money on this. How are we saying you just smoke it?
I believe that that's the angle that they are going for.
Yeah,
because again, so if you look at the issue of trust, I get your point, but if you look at what blockchain, cryptos are running on, which is blockchain, it's actually a very trustworthy technology, so to if I can put it that lightly, because what that means is all transactions are basically on a public ledger which can be verified anytime, and there's no way to actually alter those transactions. So at the core of blockchain and cryptocurrencies is actually that trust element, and that's why they've been used in places like smart contracts, because you know that if I have a contract with you know, Ali, and we have agreed to that, he's not going to come and change the terms, and it's basically something that anyone within our network can verify that is actually true. So for me, I feel like and especially for the case of say Nigeria's Eric is alluding to, I feel like they realized there's a lot of movement, there's a lot of money flows. So the initial excuse was it's affecting the Naira, which again, I do not believe it makes sense. So it's more of the government's not understanding the technology and then reacting by basically shutting it down. And I think that's what happened even with the case of Kenya a while back. Yeah, but all in all, I hope that there's going to be that one government, one of the progressive ones. We are looking at you, Rwanda, Senegal, Ghana, Mauritius, because they are more progressive in terms of policy. And I saw South Africa did some policy geared towards actually enabling crypto and looking more at that. So we hope that one government at least sets the pace in the right direction of actually exploring use of cryptos across.
Yeah, I mean, Felix, you can chip in before we jump into potentially our last topic, because it seems like we've overrun. Anyway, yeah.
Okay.
Anyway,
I know the story about crypto is very hot. Everybody's interested in it. Maybe one thing that I would ask Papa to probably just his personal opinion, though. We've seen companies like MasterCard, we've seen Visa try to say they're trying to make certain changes to allow payment on through blockchain, through crypto actually, and we've also seen companies. Yesterday we saw on Wednesday we saw Robinhood actually say they will allow also as well withdrawals from sales, proceeds of sales on on sales from their markets that their users can be able to access through crypto. Mm-hmm. And we've also seen global giants. We've seen companies like Tesla invest in Bitcoin, and we've also seen them also accept payment for actual cars in Bitcoin. They've said they're going to set up payment so that guys can actually pay for Teslas through Bitcoin. Do you think that this is something that's that is going to build around that trust and confidence that you mentioned?
I think so. Yeah. Awesome. I think all the examples that you just mentioned, mm-hmm, will help build that trust,
yep,
and build much more credibility for the instrument.
Yeah.
And I think what's interesting is that, like, let's say in the US, mm-hmm, people who have concerns about Bitcoins are typically people from what we call like the old generation,
yeah,
Warren Buffett, the Bill Gates, who maybe don't have enough understanding about the product. It's amazing that companies such as Tesla are actually pushing that agenda forward, and then some of the, you know, payment companies that you mentioned as well are also,
yeah,
helping in building that credibility.
Yeah, and I think maybe the other thing, Eric, that, mm-hmm, is interesting to watch, especially this year around crypto, is Coinbase IPO.
Yeah.
Because again, that would be
massive,
like essentially a private company going public,
yeah,
that actually exclusively
deals
in crypto.
Yeah.
So, and for me, I'm waiting to invest in Coinbase.
Interesting.
Me too, 100%.
And one of the things that came out this week was that actually Coinbase handled the Tesla transaction of 1.5.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And you know what? There's actually disclosure that they have five, mm-hmm,
other corporates.
Yeah, they
major
have five Fortune 500
companies.
So it's,
yeah,
only Tesla that has gone public with their
Bitcoin holdings,
on their,
yeah,
on their hold. Yeah.
And I'm sorry, today we won't get to tackle every single thing that we wanted to.
So
we'll just dive right into companies going public, and we'll have to speak a bit about SPACs. So speaking about SPACs, we'll have to just dive right into Tejantium. So anyone who knows me knows I'm a fanatic, a fanboy. Fanatic is not the word. I'm a fanboy of Tejan and what he's been able
and
to
that's,
do.
That's just how you left Chamath.
I am a fanboy, very black.
Of
minority
Chamath
person. Any minority person.
Chamath has been,
yeah, actually, my business partners think I'm crazy about Chamath because we relate the same. Anyway, but I mean, I'm a huge fan of what Tejan has been able to do across his career, leading Credit Suisse and everything else. And right on, we learned a few weeks back that he's assembled a team of killers, launching a $250 million SPAC, backed by both PIMCO and JP Morgan. Obviously speaks highly about his credibility as an individual and the team he's been able to assemble. And what they're going to do is they're investing in financial services companies across the emerging markets. So this is not particularly a new model. Atlas Mara tried to do it a bit on a very smaller scale, but then obviously this just gives a lot of credibility to what Chamath and his team are doing. And Papa right here, who's a guest on us today, did write a very, very interesting piece on Kenyan Wall Street, speaking about that and what it truly means. And I don't want to dilute it. I feel like that would be adding too much water to the broth. It's not my place to do it. So maybe Papa can speak a bit about the article, what he thinks about this, and generally why he has a bit of confidence in this direction.
Sure. I'll start with something you just mentioned. SPACs are not new. So
yep.
It is not a new instrument or a new asset class, but right now it's the new, you know,
wave.
It's a new wave. It's a new trend. I think so far in the U.S., $26 billion have been raised,
mm-hmm,
by SPACs. I,
yeah,
think since the beginning of the year, which is a huge number. I think the interesting about SPACs is that they basically give a lot of leverage to people behind them. So as you mentioned, Tijan Cham is someone who has a lot of credibility. So as an investor, you're literally relying on his expertise, on his network of relationships across Europe and across emerging markets to find the right deal in the financial services space. Tijan is someone who's been always passionate about Asia. And
oh, yeah. He actually did drive Prue more towards
tried,
Asia.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And he knows Europe extremely well. So SPACs, just to explain how they're structured, they're literally, blank check companies that actually take companies public through reverse mergers. So they would actually list and then merge with a company in a way to take them public. So that way makes them a little bit different from, let's say, a typical IPO.
Yeah.
And many credible investors have started SPACs. You mentioned Shamat, Tijan Cham, Bill Ackman, who raised
the biggest
SPAC,
4.2 billion.
Almost $5 billion.
Oh, Masa is also doing one?
Week. Yeah.
Really?
Oh, shit.
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
Wow. Everyone is announcing.
Guys, I'm sorry, but we're also raising the Curious LLP fund.
Yes. Soon enough. Yeah, but I think, Papa, from your article, so I read it and I ask me the question because you, from your deduction, you expect him to invest in companies in LATAM or Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And, I couldn't help but think, why not Africa? Because we have companies that fit his bill. So if you're looking, if we can get together what Jumo, Flutterwave, five such companies that actually have that scale of actual volumes and are in that space of payments, why did you look at LATAM and Asia and not companies in Africa that could actually fit the bill?
It's a good question. My opinion is that I read the thing, it's like 140 pages that they published.
The prospectus.
Mm-hmm. The prospectus, yeah. Mm-hmm. And what they mention is that they will target select African countries.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Which basically means they will target Kenya,
South Africa. And Nigeria.
Yes.
That's it.
The end.
Right?
True.
So we're looking at three countries on the continent. But I think the reason why I don't believe that they will be looking for or actively closing deals in Africa is that SPACs are easy to raise, and this is something Shamat has mentioned, but very difficult to execute.
True.
100%.
And when you look at the fee structure, it makes much more sense to have a very large transaction in Asia or in Latin America. Maybe $100 million in Asia, $100 million in Latin America, collect the fees, move on to a new SPAC.
Okay.
And I think that brings me to the dangerous aspect of SPACs is that
mm-hmm.
sometimes the interest of maybe the sponsors are not aligned with the interest of public investors.
Yeah.
That's why I fundamentally don't believe that TJAM will be targeting African companies, because it would be extremely difficult to execute and he wouldn't want to actually take that reputational risk. He would rather do straightforward deals in Asia, in Latin America, collect the fees, set up a new SPAC.
Sure.
But that's just my opinion.
Okay. I quite agree with you because if you're looking at potentially getting exposure to a bank that is operating in African markets with enough credibility, enough scope, enough size, how many banks are you looking at? Echo, Access, UBA,
mm-hmm.
potentially Equity Bank?
Not yet. You're done
with the list.
Uh-huh.
You're done with the list.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're trying to do a pan-African wide transaction, either the ticket sizes or some of those banks are so small, or even the large banks have such narrow scopes in terms of coverage of the African market, which is not the same case as in Asia or as in Latin America. So I sort of like quite understand. So he potentially would get involved in a very small transaction here, but it still wouldn't make any sense.
Yeah. So our wait for the SPACs in Africa continue?
Yeah, we have to wait. I mean, Eric, you have a company right here. Do you want us to take it public?
No.
Oh,
here's my idea now. I have the dreams of going public someday.
100%.
I honestly believe we'll see a SPAC on the continent this year.
We will.
So hopefully Kenya, Nigeria, or South Africa,
one of these guys. Flutterwave would make a very, very good
Flutterwave,
Jumo candidate.
Like, they're really, really big companies, or, quite sizable, that could actually list 30% what they are.
But do you think that it would make much more sense for them to take the SPAC route or to just do a typical IPO?
I think it didn't make much more sense to do a typical IPO, in my opinion.
A good
way.
I think one of the companies that will easily fit in there will be Interswitch. But I think Interswitch is
already
listed
public.
Yeah,
they're already public. I feel like on this continent, it's just with a spark, there's just little confidence from Western investors who would be the majority investors in that. So the traditional IPO route with the typical institutional guys would make much more sense for the credibility perspective of it. Because, I mean, imagine Flutterwave listing and then getting a valuation of what, like $500 million. This is a company that did $7.5 billion in transactions last year.
But
I mean, it's highly...
Again, the IPO, I don't think the IPO makes sense for them.
They would rather
do a SPAC.
Yeah.
Because 7.5 billion, that's quite sizable.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
They would obviously be very undervalued on any IPO listing.
IPO listing, yeah.
Because, again, primarily those markets do not understand Africa well enough.
Not yet, yeah.
Yeah.
So, guys, I'm sorry if today we touched a lot of things and not in-depthly as you'd have hoped, but we're trying to race against time to cover everything that we hoped. We didn't even get to half of the things. I'm also sorry that the ladies in the group today
decided
not to speak
talk.
Other than Eunice.
There you go.
The 2 minute contribution.
No, Anna, you have to say hi.
Yeah, Anna, do you want to say hi?
Hi.
There you have it, folks. That's the deepest insight from Anna today.
Yeah.
So,
drops mic.
Yes. Final thing, as usual, we always call shots.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes.
Are we calling shots on Bitcoin? Is Bitcoin going to go to
the moon?
To the moon.
Of course.
284 kilometers, 835. 284,834 miles.
My man. I don't know.
By the way, as at now, Bitcoin is already at 54.
I'm just hoping that Bitcoin goes
wow.
to whatever levels it's going to go so that Chamath can buy out the Hamptons and call them Hamptons.
And then
buy Goldman Sachs.
Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, yeah. And then here's a very important thing that someone just tweeted out today. If Warren Buffett had invested all his net worth in Bitcoin in 2009,
yeah,
he'd actually be worth $719 trillion today.
That's
obscene.
Then you'd give every American $1 trillion and still have 400 trillions left.
Wait, but there's only 21 million Bitcoins.
Exactly. And
to that end,
misinformation. thanks so much for tuning in. The humor, the jokes. And this was fun. See you on the next one. And we promise to cover less and talk more. Bye bye.
And just before we go again, check out our sponsors, the Hisa app. It's available on the Google Play Store and the Android App Store. It's the best place to get information on markets, both local and global, as well as amazing podcasts like this one and more others. Thank you so much and goodbye.
Let me drop an Easter egg in there. So if you listen to this podcast, in 2 weeks' time, you're going to see data from 10 African markets beyond just the Kenyan market.
Nice. Right.
So drop us some comments.
Nice.
See you guys on Hisa.
See you guys on the next one. Adios and thanks for tuning in.
Over and out.